NPR.org/shop.
Good evening, and welcome to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. It's graduation time across the country, with colleges and universities holding their commencement exercises, including Boston University earlier today. In honor of all the hard work leading up to this important milestone in a young person's life, we thought we'd share with you some of that work. Specifically, stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication here at Boston University. The students were given the following assignment: pick any major issue or topic and file a story or commentary on how today's attitudes may differ from when their baby boomer parents were young. As you might guess, the selections varied widely, ranging from college debt to sex to racial diversity. In our first two reports, Dan Trudeau explores the awaiting job market for graduates, and Lauren Nesdowski starts us off with a look at student debt.
I mean, there were two givens in my family. I think number one, you're going to college. Number two, you have to figure out how you're going to make that work.
Knowing that college was the inevitable next step after high school, Alice Sestowski began planning early. Around age 10, she picked Boston College as her dream school for the academics, the location, and the basketball. Now a senior communications major at Boston College, Listowski will graduate with a bachelor's degree and an alarming amount of debt from loans she took out to pay for college.
I would say my loans right now, federal and private combined, are probably somewhere around $90,000. And then, I mean, it'll get more with the interest and whatnot by the time I actually finally pay them all off.
Currently, undergraduates at Boston College pay $33,000 in tuition alone. Add room, board, and other costs, and students like Listowski, on average, pay around $45,000 per year.
I wouldn't go out on a limb. If I wasn't sure that I wanted to be at Boston College, I don't know that I would be willing to front this much money and, you know, put myself in this much debt. So I guess just be sure of what you're doing and make sure it's a decision that you want to make. It's a big decision, $90,000. I could do a lot with that.
Listowski and her parents discussed the issue of paying for college and the debt she would accumulate when she was applying to schools.
My parents divorced when I was young, and financially that kind of just, you know, messed with a lot of things. They both pay mortgages, and, you know, each is financially stable but not able to put away a lot of money for my sisters and myself for our education. So they pushed me towards state schools that might be cheaper, and I just kind of said I'm not going to let money stop me from where I want to go. So I have private loans and I have federal loans, and hopefully someday I'll pay them off and it won't matter.
Listowski is not alone. Nationally, one-third of college students take out loans to finance their education. According to Elizabeth Warren, a professor at Harvard Law School who specializes in debt and bankruptcy in America,
this generation will start the great race of life about 5 miles behind the starting line. There are young people today who are so committed to debt after 4 years of college that they've got to pay the equivalent of one full mortgage to make it to dead flat broke. We've put these people in economic chains so that their opportunities now become restricted.
Warren said students with debt must calculate their lives to make sure they can make big payments from 1 month to the next. This includes finding a job that will help them do so.
Can students with a lot of student debt work in public service? Nope. They've got to go into jobs that look more secure, jobs that pay better. Could Bill Gates, if he hadn't had a family to back him up, could he start a business in his garage today with $90,000 of educational loans? No way. Nope. He better go get himself into the management trainee program. It's a steady salary, it's a subsidized health care, and that's his only chance to keep making those payments on the student loans.
For now, Listowski is happy with her decision and doesn't worry much about her financial outlook, even though all the loans are in her name and it will be her responsibility to pay them off.
I don't have any regrets right now, but if a year from now I'm really struggling to stay afloat and making my loan payments, I probably will think differently and, you know, maybe wish I'd chosen to go to a school that had offered me more scholarship money or, you know, a state school where my tuition would have been a lot less expensive.
For Boston University's World of Ideas, I'm Lauren Nasdowski.
Daniel Rippey is days away from graduating, and
he feels really good about that.
It's kind of like in high school after you get the acceptance letter from your dream college.
Rippy, a senior at Northeastern University, found out in January that he had been chosen by Microsoft to take a high-paying job in Seattle after graduation. As a member of the National Guard, he'll complete training in Georgia this summer. But after that, it's on to Seattle for the start of his career. And while the job offer arose from hard work and good internships, Rippy realizes that kind of security is rare for someone his age.
I guess it still kind of does seem a little surreal, you know, that if you'd asked me 5 years ago when I got to college what I was going to be doing, I never, ever would have said I would have had this lined up.
Rippy's experience, high-level analytical skills, and advanced technical background make him the kind of student job recruiters dream about. And he's the kind of student Bob Richard knows well. Richard, an employer relations officer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, says the job market is hot for intelligent, business-savvy young folks who can help their employers make a lot of money. He uses a recent MIT grad as an example.
The student you talked about, as a junior, had done an internship with one of the Fortune 5s and had been offered a position after graduation that started at 80,000 base, 20,000 guaranteed in residuals every year, and a $20,000 sign-on bonus.
Richard has been helping people find work for the last 20 years. And he says the working world today is a more volatile place than it was in the past. Young people change jobs frequently, and they often find their job skills become obsolete within a year or two of starting a position. Richard says MIT grads are finding a robust market waiting for them upon graduation, and more than 40% are taking jobs in finance and management consulting, sectors that offer the fastest pace and the greatest financial reward.
The money is, by and large, phenomenal for the top candidates, and those firms are very selective about the candidates they choose. But an engineer graduating from MIT is probably looking at a starting salary somewhere between $56,000 and $65,000. That same student could work in, one of the Fortune 500 financial services firms on Wall Street, making $100,000 to $120,000.
Boston University economist Kevin Lang says growing wage inequality in the U.S. is putting more pressure than ever on young people to find the right kind of work. Lang says middle-class status and all its trappings, like owning a home or retiring with savings, might soon be the exclusive domain of a fortunate few.
It's now a disaster to be a high school dropout. I mean, it's really very hard to find a job that you can live on if you're a high school dropout, and it's a serious disadvantage not to have some post-secondary education. I think what's happening now is there's an increasing inequality even among those coming out with college degrees.
Economic statistics back up Lang's theories. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 1977, there were 17 million workers in manufacturing in the U.S. Today, there are just 14 million. Meanwhile, the number of service sector employees in this country has doubled to more than 114 million over that same period. Sectors demanding analytical skills and training, like teaching, nursing, and finance, have steadily grown. But a high wage for unskilled work is growing increasingly more elusive.
There are definitely good jobs in the service sector. I think what is the catastrophe is that the low-skilled jobs in the manufacturing sector that used to be high paid are not as available as they used to be.
Lang says a number of factors, from technological advancements to the decline of unions to changes in legal and regulatory structures, are forcing many young people to choose between low-paying jobs and more schooling. Liam Hurley, a senior at Boston University, is going for an advanced degree in psychology at Tufts. He says all his graduating friends are deciding it prudent to pursue a similar path.
Some people may just not want to go into the workforce yet and just are like, I'll just do another year or two of school. And some are probably thinking that the job outlook with just a bachelor's degree isn't what they were hoping it would be.
All of which shows that, for the right kind of student, today's economy offers tremendous opportunities, even at a young age. So as BU economist Lang is quick to point out, educated, talented grads are getting richer quicker than at any time in the past. It's the prospects for everyone else that he finds troubling. For Boston University's World of Ideas, I'm Dan Trudeau.
Academic Science is a boys' club.
Student reporter Karen Rowan.
Every once in a while, a woman becomes a member, but it doesn't happen all that often. Dr. Cassandra Smith, a Boston University engineering professor, recalls meeting one of those female trailblazers, Dr. Roslyn Yalow, winner of the 1977 Nobel Prize in Medicine.
And she was wearing her Nobel Prize on a chain around her neck. She punched a hole in it. And, you know, it's larger than a quarter. It's a pretty big gold piece. So I went over to her introduce myself, and I was trying to get her to give me some sympathy for women in science. And I said, you know, it's really tough being a woman in science. And she said to me, well, you don't know what tough is. And I had a laugh at my complaints. She probably encountered much more prejudice than I did.
Smith is a trailblazer herself. She was the first female professor at BU to get tenure in the engineering department. And as one of just four women in her department of 33 people, Smith has long recognized the challenges of being a woman in science.
What has happened in engineering, there has been a lot of women who have simply left.
It's called the leaky pipeline. While more women than ever enter science programs, many don't stay. The University of Michigan conducted a comprehensive study of the problem and found that while women accounted for 27% of the undergrad engineering students, that number dropped to 19% in the graduate program. Just 9% of the engineering faculty were women. Women in science must choose. If they remain in academia, they will be paid less and have fewer chances for promotions than their male counterparts. In industry, women are more on par with men and the hours are generally shorter. Just down the street from Smith's office, in Boston University's biology labs, young women in science struggle with a decision. Melanie Herskovich is a biology graduate student.
I would love to have my own lab one day and work in academia. Although I do feel in the past few years maybe my idea of the future has changed, especially because I am getting married. And not that my aspirations have become less, but I don't know if I could manage everything at once.
Herskovich serves on the Organizing Committee of Women in Biology, or WIB. The group plans gatherings with experienced female scientists who offer advice about careers and family lives. Grad student Elizabeth Tanner.
The biggest thing we think that women need is relationships with other women. And so that was our main goal, is to foster mentoring relationships.
Another reason women get out of academia is universities often have no maternity leave for students. It takes a long time for a student to rise to a faculty level position, usually more than a decade. So women must either wait until their mid-30s to have children or face losing their insurance and delaying graduation even longer.
I've always thought I wanted to go the academic route. I really like the idea of having my own lab and, you know, deciding what route my science is going to take. I'm really torn right now between, you know, 10 and 12 hour days and, you know, an industry career where I could work 6 or 8 hour days. But at the same time, you know, I'd really like to have a family. And so I don't know. I'm a little discouraged right now.
WIB is pressing Boston University's administration to create a student policy.
And what about the general atmosphere in the lab toward women? Elizabeth Ewan.
It's kind of like you're a girl in the boys' club and you can be equal in research and in thinking about science and talking about science. But then when it comes to everything else in a day-to-day basis that goes on in the boys' club, you need to be a part of that conversation that sometimes may or may not be as sensitive as it could be.
Boston University psychology professor Deborah Bell is the chairperson of Women in Science and Engineering. She says that it's often very hard for women to realize they've encountered discrimination.
If you ask a room full of people, are women discriminated in the sciences? People would say yes. Are women discriminated against at your university? Smaller number. Are women discriminated against in your department? Smaller number. So I think there is a kind of a psychological inability to see it when it affects one personally. The world has transformed itself since I was in college or since I was a young adult. What has not changed is that women are still rarely represented in the higher levels. And pay is still quite disparate. So there is dramatic change to point to, but there are still pockets of resistance and lack of change.
For Boston University's World of Ideas, I'm Karen Roan in Boston.
Student reporter Diana Epstein has our next story.
I will be the first one to go to a professional school in the sense of becoming like a doctor, engineer, or lawyer. I'm planning to go to law school.
Adrian Hope was lucky. She is an African-American woman graduating with a degree in international relations.
My mother doesn't remember my first word, but she remembers my first standardized test score.
While her mother and grandmother attended historically black colleges, their options were limited.
For my grandparents, it legally wasn't an option for them to attend a white university. And then for my mother, she attended a white university for some time and then transferred her sophomore year because she was unhappy.
Adrienne's mother became a teacher and had a comfortable middle-class life. But for her daughter, the opportunities are limitless.
When my mom looks at me and the opportunities that I have, she is baffled. She is amazed. The fact that I can, like, look around and have access to all these different opportunities. Like, my mom went to college and she became a teacher. The fact that I can look around and say, well, mommy, I might want to be a diplomat, or mommy, I might want to be president, or, like, I mean, obviously really naive statements. The fact that I can even say that, that it's an option for me, makes my family so happy.
While there have been improvements in the past generation, not every African American has had the same good fortune as Adrienne. Only about a quarter of college-age blacks go to college, and even after they get in, only about half stay in and graduate, in part because of cost. In 1976, African Americans were about 10% of the total student body enrolled in public and private degree-granting institutions. By 2002, that number was only 12.4%. A generation ago, about 40% of black households were considered middle class, compared with about 60% of white households. Now, nearly 60% of black households are deemed middle class. Harvard sociology professor Orlando Patterson says poverty is the single greatest problem facing African Americans.
There's evidence that the poor have not only remained poor, but they've lost out. That is, if you look at the bottom fifth of the black American population, they earn less in constant dollars than they did back in 1977. They have a much smaller proportion of the national income than, say, the bottom fifth of the white population. So they're if anything, worse off economically.
Boston University economist Bob Margo says that the real problem is getting more blacks into college in the first place so that they can become part of the new knowledge economy.
The problem is not like it was 50 years ago, which is breaking down barriers. The problem is getting in, is basically following this path toward education in the first place. If that happens, the American labor market rewards people pretty much independently of race. Not perfectly, but pretty much independently of race. The problem is that pathway, getting into college, is the big trick, as it were. And it's because it's become, in some ways, more difficult, you see this growing divide within the black community.
Boston University history professor Allison Blakely argues that what is needed are better elementary and secondary schools to prepare kids for college, as well as funding to help those who can't afford college tuition. He believes that still too many are falling through the cracks, and there is no accidental correlation between color and who is missing out.
I don't think there's that much of a mystery about what needs to be done. It's pretty clear what is needed, but what has been lacking is the will and the prioritization that will give these kinds of issues higher importance.
And according to economist Margo, for students like Adrienne Hope, who do manage to get that college degree, the future is bright.
We talk about two people who go to BU, went to high school, did very well, come to BU, do very well. One happens to be black, one happens to be white. We don't generally observe vastly different experiences after that point, which we used to do 60, 70 years ago. We don't observe that anymore.
For Boston University's World of Ideas, I'm Diana Epstein.
This is WBUR. I'm Dolores Handy. You're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. We just heard four reports. Diana Epstein looked at issues facing African Americans. Karen Rowan looked at women in science. Dan Trudeau explored the prospective job market, and Lauren Nasdowski led us off with a report on student debt. Our next segment of the program features stories on the techno-generation gap, sexual attitudes, and this report from Lauren Cox on today's independent music scene.
It's almost as sad as being in a bar and not having a beer on you. One God of a place is a pub with no beer.
Indie is music. It's a subculture. It's local venues and underground popularity. The members of a Boston indie band named 3 Day Threshold recently played in the Abbey Lounge, a local bar with dark walls and a big Michelob light sign outside. Tuning up in the back room, 3 Day Threshold's founder, Keir Burns, describes their sound.
It's basically like punk bluegrass, a little bit of country, a little bit of Celtic, a little bit of good old American roots rock.
Three-Day Threshold guitarist Colt Thompson explains why his band calls itself indie.
Indie means a lot of things these days in music, and I guess in our aspect, indie wouldn't really be our style of music per se. Indie's more the DIY principles behind how we're running the show, you know what I mean? We're funding all our own recording, we're doing all this touring, booking all our shows ourselves, doing a lot of like underground marketing kind of stuff. So in that aspect, we're definitely indie.
So if 3 Day Threshold is in the indie business and the indie culture, but doesn't have an indie sound, what is an indie sound? That was Modest Mouse. They're called an indie band, but they're signed with a label under Sony. Their last album went platinum, and they get mainstream radio play.
That's where the gap comes, is that indie, as a sound, they could be indie sounding, as Modest Mouse is, I guess. They're not really doing the indie thing anymore, yet their sound could be considered indie. And that's where we're kind of like doing the indie thing, which, you know, is kind of cool.
The indie confusion can continue. Like any other band, indie bands want more listeners. They want popularity. But an indie band often finds a listener with an indie fan, a person who seeks out the unknown and the underground. An indie fan can take secret pleasure in listing good bands you haven't even heard about. To confuse an older generation even more, none of this happens on the radio.
I think one of the best places to go to find new music that you never would have thought you'd hear from before is just browse top friends on MySpace. Seriously, it's a really good way to kind of like navigate across the world of music. And then, you know, there's lots of places like SonicBids is a great community of independent musicians, and it's just independents doing their own thing, making the business work for them all on their own. So those are cool, good spots. The internet, that's the place to go. Type in anything, you're going to find a band somewhere that's doing cool stuff.
Network marketing of music on the internet has to be something of this generation. It's allowed individuals to become the talent scouts independent music labels traditionally were in America. John Kellogg, a professor of music business and management at Berklee College of Music, explains.
Independents have always been the people that have gone out and discovered new talent, new genres, and really made those genres popular. In the 40s, independent companies like Atlantic Records started, and they saw a great market in recording jazz and blues. I mean, rock music was first really recorded by a lot of independent companies until maybe 69, when Clive Davis went to Woodstock and saw how strong and how great a movement rock musicians were, and he signed a number of artists that he saw there.
A cycle started. Once independent labels gained enough popularity on their own, major labels bought them out and turned them over to the mainstream. The internet might have destroyed that cycle.
I learned something interesting talking with some people over at a major radio station. The whole discussion was how modern-day commercial radio sucks. It's terrible. On late-night television shows or just TV and David Letterman, they're having all these acts that you never hear on the radio. But they're on there because they've sold so many albums. That's why they're on there. But because people are going elsewhere and finding different music, so indie works.
For Boston University's World of Ideas, I'm Lauren Cox.
Thank you all for coming out tonight.
My mom and I have never had an adult conversation about sex.
No, I'm not very comfortable talking about it.
Student reporter Maggie Haskins.
But I would like her thoughts on the vocabulary of sex, circa 2007. First up, hooking up.
I think the hooking up thing is something that I'm not even sure to the degree to which, does it mean making out or having sex?
Hooking up is an umbrella term for sexual behavior ranging from making out to sexual intercourse. A vague term, not around in 1972.
Oh yeah, it was definitely still dating. It wasn't exclusively dating, but it was very much dating, and it was very much going with someone.
Next, friends with benefits.
I think that's so strange. I just think it's just, I can't get my head around it. I don't get it.
Friends with benefits means two friends engaging in sexual behavior, or hooking up, with no commitment.
Sexual relations should be based on, if not love, at least a real sense of caring about the individual that who you're with. So it shouldn't be a stranger. It shouldn't just be totally physical. It shouldn't be something that you do when you're high or drunk. Young people should be really talk about how they're going to feel.
But did my mom talk to her college friends about sex?
No, well, you really didn't talk about it. I talked a lot about the war in Vietnam and a lot about Nixon.
She wishes she was talking about Iraq and Bush right now. I move on to the pill.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was an issue of equality. I don't think young women were thinking about the feminine mystique. I think they were just thinking about having the freedom to have sexual relations without serious repercussions.
One more term, lugs. Lesbians until graduation. A lug is a term used on college campuses to describe heterosexual females who, for a period of time, choose to hook up with or date a female.
I think it sounds like women in prison.
But lug-esque behavior is on the rise, according to a new study by the National Survey of Family Growth. Roughly 15% of 18 to 29-year-old women have had at least one homosexual encounter, up from just under 10% for women between 30 and 44. The language has changed, but what else is different about the sexual behavior of my generation? When it comes to premarital sex, not much, according to Dr. Lawrence Feiner's recent study.
People are having premarital sex. Almost everybody is.
But this is not new behavior. Dr. Feiner's study reported 74% of women born in the 1980s had premarital sex by age 20. And that percentage is the same for women born in the 1970s and 1960s. What has changed about our generation? Our average age of marriage is now in the late 20s.
We've been thinking about a little catchphrase of like the early 20s are the new teens, with the idea that, you know, it used to be that people got married earlier, and now you have this longer period. In what way do people who are in their early 20s now behave in terms of their partnership patterns, in terms of their sexual patterns, perhaps more similarly to people who are in their late teens than to people who have, you know, married, you know, or only having one partner?
But does this longer period of being both sexually active and single mean my generation is automatically more irresponsible when it comes to sex? Incidence of contraceptive use by my generation is much higher than previous generations, meaning we protect ourselves better than our parents did. Boston University nurse practitioner Joan Sullivan Lipsett recalls the lack of information about safe sex when she was a young woman in the 1970s.
Chlamydia, where they didn't even have a test for it. You know, condoms, I don't remember. I know I saw like jokes, Woody Allen movies about condoms, but other than that, I wasn't terribly aware of condoms. But I assure you, the chlamydia rates were extremely high.
Nurse Sullivan has just given me a comprehensive sex ed class in flyer form. There's a sheet about birth control, STD, HPV, and my favorite, the updated herpes handbook. Such access to information, counseling, and services is a world away from the student health centers of 25 years ago. But not everything has changed.
I think that the bulk of all reproductive health, you know, still lies with women. I don't think that's changed. But I don't see a lot of the men. Maybe they are thinking about, you know, preventing pregnancy and preventing STDs.
Choice defines us now. We can choose to take the pill or use a condom or whether we want to wait. We can choose who we love, man, woman, or both. And we must live with HIV/AIDS. That is today's reality, even if older generations just can't seem to get their head around the idea. For Boston University's World of Ideas, I'm Maggie Haskins.
Welcome to the technology generation.
Emily Reddy narrates this story, written and produced by student reporter Eva Zadeh.
I'm probably connected to my laptop or some sort of computer at least 4 to 6 hours a day.
Like, I would love to not have a cell phone, but at the same time, I know I need to have one because how else are you supposed to connect with people or talk to them?
I never turn my laptop off, so whenever I have a free moment, I'm pretty much using that. And I text people throughout the day.
I am an obsessive checker of my email.
My laptop's my life. I could probably live without my iPod. I don't imagine myself living without my laptop or my cell phone. Because if I go a day without them, I freak out.
According to a Mintel report, as of November 2006, 69% of the young adult population in the U.S. owned a cell phone, and 82% owned a personal computer. 1 in 8 say they can't live without their cell phone. 1 in 4 without their PC. Personal computers, laptops, and cell phones appeared in the beginning of the 1980s, but laptops and cell phones were not widely used until the late 1990s. Thinking back to when we didn't have all these devices, we wonder how our parents' generation got along without them. And how do they deal with technology devices today? Patricia Niadovsky is 59 years old. She's a teacher's aide at a middle school in Guilford, Connecticut. She owns a cell phone, and that's it.
But I don't use it often because most times it's off. When I was 20 years old, there was a phone. It hung on the wall. You used it when you needed it.
And Niadovsky likes to keep her life simple.
When I come home from work, I don't run to the computer to check my email like my young daughter. Instead of using the email, I like to pick up the phone because I just like that personal touch.
Niadovsky is not the only one to feel the personal touch is lost with all this new technology. Many parents worry their children have become tethered to machines, iPods, laptops, and cell phones. But Joshua Green, an MIT researcher, argues technology is a great way to stay closely connected.
Email reinvigorated written communication because all of a sudden we had a very easy way to write to people, and it's low cost, it's quick, it's efficient.
Green thinks we should avoid stereotyping older people as technology phobic and young people as technology lovers. He says our relationship with technology depends on how we use it.
The current generation of young people relate to technologies in a different way because they don't see technology as something elite or something that is reserved for work. They're much more used to technology being around them, but they're also much more used to just poking it to see what happens.
Green says there are profound differences in the lives we live now and how we lived a generation ago. Today we're surrounded by technology. Some think its ubiquity has an effect on the way we build interpersonal relationships. But Green disagrees.
I'm not sure that technology itself has an adverse relationship on interpersonal relationships. How has it changed interpersonal relationships? I think that we have increased the degree to which we discuss things, keep track of things, and talk about things. Do I think that's necessarily negative? No.
Green thinks people have the capacity to maintain more relationships than past generations could, and keep track of them. Technology allows people to overcome space and distance in ways they couldn't even imagine a generation ago, and can give people new opportunities in a simple click. For Boston University World of Ideas, I'm Emily Reddy.
That story on the techno generation gap was written and produced by student reporter Eva Zadeh. Before that, we heard from Maggie Haskins on changing sexual attitudes, and Lauren Cox on today's independent music scene. This is WBUR. I'm Dolores Handy with a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. In our final segment of the program, we explore how attitudes are changing as America becomes a more multicultural, multiracial society. First, though, we have a story on fear from student reporter Amy Ray.
The Cold War, a power struggle between Western powers and Communist Russia, spanned a period of over 40 years, from the end of World War II until the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. The war touched Africa, Asia, Europe, America, and the Middle East, and for generations there existed the threat of nuclear annihilation. In early 1959, a group called the Kingston Trio released a song called The Merry Minuet. Penned by Broadway lyricist Sheldon Harnick, the song encompassed the fear of nuclear attack that still existed throughout the Cold War. The trio produced folk music rooted in American popular culture and delivered it with a comic twist. Here's a live recording of a trio performance from 1959.
And we know for certain that some lovely day someone will set the spark off and we will all be blown away.
Angelo Codaviglia, professor of international relations at Boston University, believes this fear of nuclear annihilation was irrational.
Anyone who had any scientific knowledge knew perfectly well that the amount of radioactivity generated by the explosion of every nuclear warhead in the world couldn't possibly have generated enough radioactive material to do serious harm to a significant chunk of the Earth's population. That just was not physically possible.
In England, a country faced with terrorist attacks from the Irish Republican Army for decades, Cold War tensions took a back seat to the more immediate threat of an IRA attack. David Johnson is 58 years old and lives in the northeast of England.
The worst part for me was the 80s, where there was a lot of IRA bombing activity all over the UK, some quite close to where I live, in the northeast. They blew up a power plant. Another time it was when I had 7 different visits to London on which a bomb went off, and one of them actually gave the taxi my wife and I were in quite a bad shake, and we saw clouds of smoke very close by.
The attacks on 9/11 brought to America the terrorism experienced for years in Europe and other parts of the world, and Americans now have to consider a new fear, perhaps more worrisome than the Cold War. Again, Professor Codaviglia.
Terrorist acts are meaningful primarily, almost exclusively, insofar as they affect those who are not themselves struck. That's the entire point of terrorism, of course, to make the point that no one is safe. It has much less to do with the relative power of the terrorists, which is very, very small, than with the notion that the terrorist cannot be stopped, and above all, that the cause for which the terrorists fight cannot be stopped.
Yet Professor Codaviglia says Americans need to keep terrorism in perspective. He says your chance of being killed by a terrorist are less than being hit by lightning. John Templeton is a 23-year-old law student in London. He says that Americans can learn from the British experience with the IRA. He says terrorism is an unfortunate part of modern life, but should not dominate our daily lives.
I think 9/11 certainly sort of made a point that everybody's vulnerable, but my fears are exactly the same before and after. It wouldn't alter the way I do anything, because if you do, you let terrorists win.
Terrorism is a state of fear that the West continues to live with. It produces greater fears than those that existed in the Cold War because of its unpredictability. During the Cold War, the United States and the USSR were restrained by the fear of mutual destruction. Both nations cared about self-preservation, a motivation that today's suicide bombers do not seem to share. For Boston University's World of Ideas, I'm Amy Ray.
Now, student reporter Elisa Mamolo.
Tonight, as I enter into the Dante Alighieri Hall, I feel like I'm taking a step back in time. An Italian and American flag drape the hall's doorway, and as I cross over the threshold, I leave the year 2007 behind and enter into old Italy. For any other 22-year-old, he or she may feel like they are in an unknown foreign world, but for me, this is a well-known place. Since the time I was a little girl, each month I would attend a dinner dance with my Italian-born parents and grandmother at the Regina Margherita di Savoia Ladies' Lodge at the Sons of Italy Hall in Waltham. The society is such a regular part of my grandmother's life that even when I ask her why she's a member, she gives me a funny look and answers with a matter-of-fact tone.
everything. You know, it used to stay together once a month. And you do so many things. And then besides, it's a new culture from Italy, and then you keep it going.
For more than 600,000 members nationwide, the Sons of Italy acts as glue that holds various Italian communities together. The vice president of the Sons of Italy Massachusetts Grand Lodge, Florence Kane.
They started off out in New York. It was a place where they all could get together so that they, in fact, could be together and be like family.
But Kane and other members fear the association may have already reached its peak.
We're hoping that the young get involved and keep it going, because if the young don't get involved, there will not be a Sons of Italy.
Here at the Margherita di Savoia Hall, the term generation gap takes full form. A majority of the guests are over the age of 50. In fact, out of approximately 80 people, only 5 guests are under the age of 30.
It's not only look around the room and everyone looks so different, but everything's different. It's like stepping back in time. The music is different. The food is different. And I think that's priceless.
That's Andrea Rose. At 25 years old, she is the youngest member at her lodge.
I would rather spend my nights here and remember how wonderful things were and dream about what it was like to be my grandmother's age and look at all the older people and love and then dancing and whispering each other's ears than being out some loud, crazy club with ecstasy running around.
The members of the Sons of Italy fear that Andrea Rose's opinion is a view that is not held by many of today's young Italian-Americans. 31-year-old Amy Young says as a first-generation Italian-American, she feels a strong connection to her Italian heritage and wants her 1-year-old daughter to feel the same. But Young thinks, for her, the Sons of Italy isn't the answer.
I think for them it's a social thing, and they get to see people, and it gets them out of the house to do other things, whereas I think my age group would rather go to a bar and have a couple drinks versus go to the Sons of Italy.
According to the U.S. Census Bureau, in 1910, approximately 1,340,000 Italians came to the States. But in the 10-year span between 1990 to 2000, the number of Italian immigrants was about 32,600. Young thinks that along with a decreasing number of Italian immigrants also comes a decreasing need to congregate. Andrea Rose thinks each generation has become more and more assimilated to the American way of life, so much that even if the Sons of Italy tries new methods to bring in a new crowd, the younger generation will not be able to capture the same passion for Italian tradition.
I pray that people show an interest at my age, those younger than me. My son will take part in this and continue it, but the reality is, and it's hurtful to say out loud, is it's not going to happen. That this Italian culture, the language, the romance of love is dying.
For Boston University's World of Ideas, I'm Alyssa Mumolo.
¿Cómo te llamas? It's the question someone asks when you don't look like you belong, and to that I respond, Nicole Acosta.
Here's student reporter Katrina Grieg-Saito.
Acosta is Chinese, Irish, and Puerto Rican. She's a 19-year-old poet and student, and she's part of a growing population of multiracial people who are constantly faced with the question, what are you?
First day of high school, I was in native language Spanish, whispers of La Gringa. Switched me out because my eyes didn't match my last name. Must have been some huge mistake.
When Matthew Ruddy, a musician and school teacher, gets asked the same question, he says,
I'd gotten pretty good at taking one long deep breath and sort of firing it all out at once and putting a period at the end of it. I guess when people ask, when people want to really know what am I sort of ask them how much time they have.
Matthew's a mixed-race adoptee in a family that is a microcosm of America's diversity. His biological mother is white, and his biological father is black. Matthew's family consists of his adoptive parents, who are white, his older brother Jeremy, who was adopted from Korea, his younger sister, who was also adopted and is half black and half white, though not related to Matthew by blood, and his younger brother, who is his parents' biological son.
there pretty much was not another family in town like ours. So it you know, made us peculiar to a certain degree. And when you don't have a place that fits, you know, that's what you're really searching for as a kid, is something to assimilate to and find some comfort in.
But for some people, the search for identity is a more difficult journey. Jeremy Ruddy committed suicide in 2003.
I think it's pretty safe to say that my brother was pretty much a 100% American guy stuck in a Korean body. He even once mentioned to my mother that it astonished him to look in the mirror sometimes and see his face looking back at himself.
Kelly Bates is the vice president of the Maven Foundation, an organization formed to educate people about the challenges of being mixed.
Identity is very powerful, so much so that what we know is that if children and even adults don't get support in developing their self-esteem around their identity, they're more likely to suffer from depression. We see some high suicide rates from children who are multiracial.
Being mixed in the 1950s was very unusual and often kept secret. Light-skinned blacks were said to be able to, quote, pass as white, a very different matter. In fact, Alexander D'Souza has gone through life believing she was of only European descent and didn't even know that her father was mixed until after his death. Her father was born in 1915.
He didn't talk about his family much, and if there was a secret, he took it with him to the grave, so I've been digging ever since. There were times when people would always come up to him and say, "Oh, where did you get that marvelous tan?" It really wasn't until last year that I kind of had it confirmed that he essentially was passing his entire life.
Alex found the marriage records of her father's parents and learned her father was, quote, colored from the British West Indies. When Alex asked her mother why she hadn't ever asked him about it.
I just never cared about that. Your father and I, you know, we knew we were soulmates and that we had to be together, so it didn't matter what he was or I was or anything. We just knew we had to be together. And look what we got for it. 31 years of marriage and two beautiful daughters.
Kelly Bates from the Maven Foundation.
What we want people to have now is more of a sense of pride around it, not feel like they have to hide, that they have a place where they belong, they have more information than they had before. And they still get to embrace all those other categories and all those racial backgrounds that they have, but they get to have all of them, not just one, not just a half. You're not a half. I always like to say you're 100% of all of those things.
And that will be the challenge of the 7 million Americans who define themselves as mixed, and many, many more who will follow in an increasingly global, multicultural, multiracial society.
I am Chira Sheikin, Chinese, Irish, and Puerto Rican combined.
For Boston University's World of Ideas, I'm Katrina Grigg-Saito.
Puerto Rican combined. No, I won't make your pork fried rice. I won't wash your clothes.
Who are you? Where do you come from? I've never known how to answer those questions.
Student reporter Eva Zadeh.
Tonight I'm with my boyfriend. We've just had dinner in the North End, the Italian neighborhood here in Boston. And I find myself again in between cultures. We jump in a cab and start chatting in French in the back of the taxi. The driver interrupts us and asks where we come from. I answer that we're French. But he says, "You have another accent." I tell him I was born in Paris and ask where he comes from. "I'm from Lebanon," he answers. My heart starts beating a little faster. I'm smiling and shaking at the same time. "I was born in France, but my father is from Lebanon." Back in the taxi, the driver is pleased. "I knew it," he says. "You rolled the R." "Yes, my father is from Lebanon. But my grandfather was born in Iran, and he married my grandmother, who is half Romanian and half Syrian. My mother, she's Tunisian. And if that's not complicated enough, I'm Jewish. So let's add it up. I am Jewish, Iranian, Lebanese, Syrian, Romanian, Tunisian, and French. That totals 7 cultures in my bag of tricks. So who am I? Where do I come from? I'm often lost in that bouillon culture. That's the French expression for a cultural melting pot. Today I study in the United States and I hang out with people who also come from mixed cultural backgrounds. I know that's become a trend, but I think that in my case, the amalgam of Jewish and Arab roots is something rare, and I hesitate to reveal too much. Where is your dad from? The taxi driver asks. Beirut, I reply. He asks my name and the neighborhood where my father lived. Zadeh, I answer. I don't know anybody from your family, he says. Of course he doesn't. The Jewish community in Lebanon numbered as many as 14,000 a generation ago. It was a significant part of Lebanon's multi-religious mosaic. But Jews began living when the civil war divided the country along sectarian lines in 1975. Today, estimates of Lebanon's Jewish population vary from between 50 to 1,000. No one is certain because those who are left often keep their religious identity secret. I stop for a second and ask myself if I should tell the taxi driver the whole story. I'm scared to tell him my dad was living in the Jewish neighborhood in Beirut. Even the wooden Christian cross swinging from his rearview mirror doesn't restore my confidence. It wasn't the first time I hesitated telling someone from Lebanon that I'm Jewish. The Lebanese hatred for Israel has been steadily growing since 1982. And the events last summer, the 32-day war between the two neighbors, hadn't helped matters. Two people that hate each other. Two countries that build my identity. Israel versus Lebanon. Do I really need to choose one side? Should I disown one part of my cultural background? In the end, I decide to make it simple. I just tell the taxi driver I don't know where my father was living. But part of me feels like I'm abandoning a piece of who I am.
Student reporter Eva Zadeh, bringing to a close tonight's special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. Our student contributors were, in order of appearance, Lauren Nastowski, Dan Trudeau, Karen Rowan, Diana Epstein, Lauren Cox, Maggie Haskins, Emily Reddy, Amy Ray, Elisa Mamalo, Katrina Grigg-Saito, and Eva Zadeh. Special thanks to Associate Professor Ann Donahue, who edited their stories. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's show was produced by Tim Skog and Michael Garth. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.